The next case for argument is State of South Dakota versus Adil Osman. For the appellant, Katie Dunn appears, will be arguing. For the appellee, Jacob Dempsey appears, he'll be arguing. Each side will have a 15-minute initial argument, and then Ms. Dunn, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You may proceed with your argument, Ms. Dunn.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Dunn, and I represent the appellant Adil Osman. Adil is currently incarcerated in the South Dakota State Penitentiary following conviction and judgment in this matter before the court. I'm here today asking this court to reverse the judgment and conviction entered and order a new trial. We're asking this for two reasons. One, because the trial court erred in denying the motion to suppress the show of identification in this matter. And two, the trial court erred in admitting hearsay testimony that prejudiced my client. Beginning first with the show of identification or the due process violation. The show of identification here was unnecessary and suggestive and led to an unreliable identification. This denied Mr. Osman due process of law. As to a denial of a motion to suppress or a due process violation, courts utilize a two-part test. The first part is to determine whether or not the identification is unnecessary and suggestive. And the second part is then to weigh the totality of the reliability of the identification versus the overall suggestiveness of the identification procedure. So going with the first part as to whether or not it was unnecessary and suggestive, we would submit today to this court that it was both. The show up here was unnecessary. This is a situation where courts repeatedly admonish single-person show-ups. And so when law enforcement is faced with this option, it should always be a last resort. And here, this was a first resort. They could have done a better procedure later on in the day. This was something that was at midnight where they could have done a lineup or a photo lineup later on after an arrest was made.
So one thing a little different here is this need to take a blood test to determine, you know, we know alcohol dissipates over time. There's some urgency in the sense of we have to figure out who's driving the vehicle. So does that create any necessity in this case, the need to take a blood test? What do you think?
So, no. I think there is, I think McNeely says you can't surpass fundamental rights to do a blood test. So I think there have to be facts there to show that was the only route, and I don't think those facts exist.
So that may cut against necessity in terms of we need to get more facts to develop this. Could the argument be they had probable cause to get a warrant at that point and at least take a blood draw from him based on what they had?
That's where I was going into.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. This is a situation where the facts were Sergeant Treadway saw him initially going through lawns at the scene and then made the stop not too many blocks away. They had the odor of intoxication, and then they later spoke with the other individuals. So there was sufficient information at least to make a probable cause arrest and then get the blood draw. So I don't think the blood draw is what made the show up necessary.
So after he was detained by Treadway, would there have been the follow-up with the follow-up with the other witnesses was sometime later. It would have been hours later. Is your view would have been enough to arrest him at the point he was initially detained and hold him and get a warrant at that point? Because it took hours to sort out who the owner of the vehicle was, where the keys came from, etc.
I think that is something, I think that's part of the process. I think that is something, if you want to follow correct police procedure, that's what they need to do. Yes, if it was going to take 2 hours, then So be it. Get a warrant, present that to a judge, and then follow the proper procedure of doing the right identification. And if it took 2 hours, it took 2 hours, and then you get a blood test, and you call a chemist as to the results there and try to make your argument.
Well, and maybe is there a distinction between necessity as it relates to the investigation? Maybe there were things that law enforcement needed to do to determine the situation, and necessity for purposes of should we be looking at reliability and how reliable this testimony is. Are those two different viewpoints or perspectives?
I think they are two different perspectives. However, I think when it comes to necessity as it relates to the identification, I think the identification here was more of an afterthought. They believed they had their individual when they made the arrest and then asked as to see if they would like to come down and do an identification and ask them if they wanted to. But for all intents and purposes, they were going to make the arrest. And so I don't think it was necessary.
Well, they could make an arrest for the DWI, right? That's your point. They had probable cause to make a DWI arrest.
Correct.
Even if they didn't have enough to make the arrest for the hit and run, or if they did or they didn't.
I think actually it would be one and the same, because if they think he was the operator of the vehicle, they would have still had the probable cause to arrest for the hit and run as well.
Don't they have to? So, okay. Well, if you put it like that, then what's their PC that he was the driver?
I think.
This is an unusual position for you.
It sure is. frankly, if they had made the arrest at the time, I probably would have been arguing a motion to suppress as well on the Fourth Amendment issue. However, theoretically, I think it comes. I think you have to add in the investigation with the Mercado's individuals, but again, that goes to the point that this is for a decision for the court to make, not for law enforcement to make. And law enforcement, again, is repeatedly admonished not to do this. And so, if they're not supposed to do it, they shouldn't do it. And if they have to get a warrant and do it the old-fashioned way, then so be it.
But the Mercado information comes significantly later, at the moment that they decide to do the show up. Do you think there's probable cause there for them to have made an arrest?
So law enforcement knew almost immediately that the vehicle was registered to Ayala Dane and is associated with Mercado. So they had information there to make that connection. As to whether or not there's probable cause, I think that's for this court to determine.
Well, your client wasn't connected to Mercado's until after the show.
Because that's when Sergeant Treadway decided to go make that. I guess we can't control how law enforcement did that. Had they done the process the right way and gone and investigated Mercado's right away once they had him detained, or had somebody else go do that, then I think they created their own.
I probably stated it wrong. So the probable cause would be probable cause maybe to get a warrant to get the blood for the DUI, because that's the argument for necessity.
Correct.
We had to do this show up lineup like this, or the show up identification, because we need to get his blood because it's going to dissipate.
I think that there were facts enough to submit to the court for a warrant. Whether or not a court would have granted it is not something I can look back and say.
So assume it was suggested and unnecessary, hypothetically. Can you address the other factor, the bigger factors?
Yes. And so when we go into whether or not the overall identification is reliable, I think what is important and what really needs to be touched on, not just as to the bigger factors, but as to weighing them against the significantly suggestive identification. And the state pointed out, I think in their brief accurately, is that when I argued this, I argued it as one identification, and it's actually two. And so when we talk about Becky Mylitz's identification, that's the primary identification that occurred here. And this occurred. The identification occurred 10 to 30 minutes afterwards, so that certainly cuts against my case. But the accuracy of her description is something where she first, on the night of the accident, describes a kid with a light-colored shirt with dark hair, and who's a male. Her statement at trial is more developed. She has shaggy hair, skinny t-shirt and jeans, and then discusses she didn't know if he was Native or Black. As to Troy Militz's statements, he said he thought he saw a female, and so his description is much different. And then compared to his statement at trial, where I knew he was a foreigner, darker complected, choppy hair, skinny jeans, light-colored shirt, and then denied stating he saw a female. And so I think a lot of this comes down to the description made here. And if you look at their two descriptions before the suggestive show-up and their description thereafter, after law enforcement did this, it is clear that the identification was a result of the suggestive show-up procedure, and that is clear in the record and the testimony from both, I think, the suppression hearing and the trial. So when you weigh that, when you look at the reliability and the versus the suggestiveness, the identification is the result of the suggestive procedure. Moving on then to my second issue, the admission of hearsay evidence from Sergeant Treadway. We would submit to the court that it was prejudicial error and an abuse of discretion for the trial court to admit that statement. And so what had occurred is that Sergeant Treadway was asked, I think on direct, as to what he learned after speaking with Michael Goulet, and we objected as to hearsay. The state argued that the judge overruled it, and the judge has stated that because I had the opportunity to cross-examine both Mr. Goulet and Mr. Adain, that the hearsay, it was not hearsay. I think that's a misapplication of 1919.801(d)(1).
What about the fundamental definition of hearsay, which requires that the statement be offered for its truth? This key was discovered after Sergeant Treadway's discussions with Mr. Day and Mr. Goulet. Police officers had found the keychain, the Fred the Fixer keychain. It didn't have the key it should have had, but he recovered it. Isn't it logical or necessary that he should be able to explain to the jury why he went looking, first of all, that there was a missing key at all, two, that he perceived the need to go look for it because it could be helpful to linking the key to the Mazda that was involved in this crash. So doesn't it have to kind of play out a little bit organically like that?
No. I think, so first of all, the statement isn't, he told me the key was missing. The statement was, he said he was the driver. So that doesn't provide any context to why he went to look for a key. And two, this is a situation where it's a DUI hit and run. They should be looking for a key. So I don't think Sergeant Treadway would have been scratching their heads wondering why he went back to the scene to go look for it.
So if you're right that there's an abuse of discretion or the rules were misapplied, help me understand prejudice. And before you answer that, here's what I would offer just as a discussion point. Goulet says, I sent Osman to go get the Fred the Fixer key ring from a Dane, which he did. The key ring had the Mazda key ring on it, and Osman had the key ring with him, which is found near the scene where the Mazda crashed. Does this statement that he was driving add a whole lot to what the jury already logically has in front of them?
Yes. This is a case where the court points out the statements, but also Ayala Dane, who had sent him to go get the keys, testified that my client did not appear intoxicated at the time he saw him, did not appear under the influence of alcohol, and had experience with individuals who are intoxicated. Michael Goulet, who had the keys, was asleep and basically said he had just gotten back from a 17-hour drive, was basically asleep, and didn't see much. And so there's nothing there to indicate that there's nothing. It was just the act of getting the keys at that point in time. That's all their testimony added. Then when we add the additional information from law enforcement where the identifications were called into question because Mr. Milets had thought my client was a female, Ms. Milets had kind of made a statement where she couldn't see anybody by the driver's side of the vehicle. The officer had a lot of suggestive statements when she brought the Miletses to make their identification. The keys weren't found initially on scene. There's multiple law enforcement officers on scene, and neither of them found that there. It was 2 hours later when Officer Treadway went back, and there was a 2-1 blood test, and the jury was deadlocked on this. Okay, so we had a very scrupulous jury who was reviewing the evidence, and even when they had something as strong as that, couldn't agree on a conviction. And so not having that statement being in there kept me from arguing that no one put him behind the vehicle. And I'm out of time. Thank you,
Ms. Dunn. Mr. Dempsey, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. We're here today because a jury convicted Adil Osman of his fourth DUI and fleeing the scene after he crashed a car into the Milets' parked pickup. Becky Milets heard the crash from her living room and went straight outside. She looked around and saw a Mazda dead at the end of the block. She ran toward it. As she approached, she saw Osman standing under a bright street light looking around the wrecked vehicle. She looked at him uninterrupted at a distance of less than half a block. Osman looked up at her, and when he saw her, he ran away. As he ran, Becky called 911 and accurately described Osman as a male with dark hair wearing light-colored clothing.
Counsel, can I interrupt you there just for a moment? In the trial court's memorandum opinion, he references Becky describing the suspect only as a male kid who was possibly Hispanic and wearing a light-colored shirt with dark hair. Where does the reference, where in the record did the trial court obtain the report that he was possibly Hispanic?
I didn't find anything in the record saying that he was possibly Hispanic. If you go to her phone call to 911, in that exhibit, she never says that he's Hispanic, and they ask her if she says a white male, and she actually corrects them and says, no, I couldn't tell. He's wearing light-colored clothes, that sort of thing. So I don't know how that entered the memorandum opinion.
Thank you for that point of clarification.
So law enforcement apprehended Osman within an hour of Becky's call, and she and Troy were taken to a show-up identification less than a mile away. Becky and Troy did not rush to conclusions at the show-up. They were deliberative. Becky asked law enforcement to shine a light on Osman, and then she had him stand at different angles, replicating the conditions that she saw him under. And after those additional measures were taken, that's when her and Troy both said that they were absolutely certain that they had the right man.
Is there any problem with both of them being together in the car, making the identification at the same time? Namely, would one's comments influence the others?
It is possible, but there's no other way to really do a show-up other than you take them to the scene of arrest.
You could put them in separate cars.
You could put them in separate cars, that's true. But that's why we have the totality of the circumstances test, to see the weight that all these different various things might have.
So why did the police need to do this suggestive show-up at the scene?
So the necessity element, what we have on necessity in Red Cloud, there's not a lot of analysis, but there's a couple things that it touches on that are relevant here. The first is that there's a photo lineup from a separate investigation available in Red Cloud. So there's going to be a photo lineup that occurs anyway. The second note that the court makes is that in paragraph 36 regarding a show-up, the court says it is advantageous to use a more reliable process, such as a photo lineup, when it is reasonably possible to do so. So that reasonable possibility in Red Cloud, in my reading, stems from the fact that there's going to be a photo lineup anyway. Here, there's no separate investigation going on. It's things are unfolding. Law enforcement isn't exactly sure what's happening. They're boots on the ground. They know they have a job to do to protect the public. They know that they have a hit and run, and an at-large suspect. Information's coming in quickly. It can be bad information. We saw that this game of telephone occurred where Becky says...
But they think they've got the hit-and-run driver because, as I recall the record, the officer says to Becky, we've got the driver.
They do. But to take it from confidence to absolute certainty...
Well, but when we're talking about necessity, you've got the... There doesn't seem to be much dispute that this was a suggested procedure. There doesn't seem to be much question about that. So then we're looking at, did law enforcement have to do the identification this way? Was it necessary? And shouldn't that be pretty narrow once you've got suggestive? For instance, and go through the reliability process? Because when you've got that suggestive element, necessity, it seems to me, is not that significant in terms of whether it's reliable or not. The suggestiveness goes to reliableness. So, you know, for instance, the U.S. Supreme Court and Deno says this person's going to die and they're the only person that can identify. That's necessary. But if we broaden necessary, I'm asking you, if we broaden necessary to say, well, we've got all these procedures and all these things we have to do to investigate, doesn't that open the gate up to any case?
I don't believe that it does because Red Cloud asked for a case-by-case analysis. So because there's that case-by-case approach, there's always going to be different factors at play.
This is a fresh crime scene, and the person who is responsible is on the move. There's flight. Active crime scene. Within a half an hour, we've got something that looks like it might be hold some promise for solving the crime. Why isn't that necessity? You probably think it is.
I do think that it is. I think, really, if this isn't necessity, then it's really probably just a situation where somebody's about to die. This is really the only reasonable things they have possible, the only reasonable means they have possible to get to that point of absolute certainty that they've caught the right person.
But we're looking at the possibility that the show-up might not yield a positive identification. Theoretically, right? You can imagine. We'll never hear about them because they don't get litigated. You could rule them out.
Yes, absolutely. And if they didn't, time's of the essence here. So if they didn't know that they had the right person, and this is getting into that Claybaugh case. Claybaugh had similar facts. There was a eyewitness identification, individual apprehended on foot within an hour. And the court noted that it was okay, one, because it happened so quickly afterward that increases the reliability, but two, because it serves the needs of law enforcement to inform them if they need to either continue or curtail their search activities.
But should we be looking at these together? In other words, do you look at the investigative needs differently than you look at admissibility? Aren't those two different questions? So if the investigative needs are, we've got to do this, that, and that, when you're talking about necessity, you know, the fallback is, even if you don't have necessity, you still look at reliability, which is exactly what we should be looking at in every case. You know, for instance, PBT, that's something that law enforcement uses as an investigative technique to narrow out suspects, determine if this person may be under the influence of alcohol, but it's not admissible because it's not reliable. So shouldn't we really be focusing on, once we have suggestive, don't we really go right to the five factors and say, let's look at reliability because this is suggestive, unless you've got an unusual situation where it's absolutely necessary?
I think if the court were to rule that this is an unnecessary show-up procedure, then we get to that territory where it's almost never going to be necessary. So was it suggestive, and then you get into the factors. And yes, as you noted, the reliability and whether or not there was a need in the investigation, they are separate questions, and that's why there's two parts of the test. So if this court does disagree and says that this wasn't a necessary circumstance, that's still not the end of the test. That's when we run through the factors. And the test is, if it's suggestive and unnecessary, we look at the substantial likelihood of misidentification. So it's got to be substantial. It's a high bar. And if there's no substantial likelihood of misidentification, the reliability outweighs the improper procedure. And here the reliability does outweigh the proper procedure. When you go through the factors.
So there's two different, there's actually four different identifications. There's two on-site and two in court. You talked to us briefly about the reliability of Becky's identification on-site, and then you talked about that, but you didn't talk about the husband's identification on-site and what he observed that made his reliable.
So They are two different individuals, and Red Cloud speaks about a witness's experience in the singular. So that's why this analysis requires looking at them each individually. On Troy, now what we know, the jury concluded, they were instructed in instruction 25 on the Red Cloud factors, and then some. It actually, the jury instructions went beyond what's required in Red Cloud. And we know that they believed either one or both of them. I've been focusing on Becky because I do think she's the stronger witness, because she never actually provides any inaccurate information about what Osman looks like. Troy does have that detail where he thought he was female at first.
Well, did he have a man bun, so to speak, the defendant?
Yes. You could,
to that in the record.
Pardon my interruption. You can see in Stephen's dash cam, Officer Stephen's dash cam, that he does have longer hair that's up in a bun. The description given is either shaggy or choppy. Sergeant Treadway also testified at trial as to seeing the man bun. So, and if you look at Osman in the video evidence, he does have a slight build. He's slender. So to see someone with longer hair, with a slender build from a distance, and initially think that they might be female, that's not enough to render the identification unreliable. And that's because, just running it through the factors, so the opportunities for the witness to view the suspect at the time of the crime, both saw him stand underneath a bright light. Becky was closer and got a longer look, but Troy did get a look at him under that bright light. The degree of attention in Red Cloud, there's this issue of weapon focus effect. There's no weapon focus effect here. They're both laser focused on the Mazda at the end of the block and the man around it. Accuracy of the description. Becky gave an accurate description in her call to 911, dark hair, male, light-colored clothes. She never said anything inaccurate. Troy, we see in his testimony at trial that he says he knew darker hair, longer hair, light-colored clothing, darker complexion. And we also find out in the testimony the jury heard that he did think that initially it was a woman. However, some inaccuracy is okay. In Red Cloud, the witness got the height, race, and clothing wrong, but that was still deemed to be sufficient. In Dope Deng Chol, which assessed a photo lineup, the height and clothing color in the identification were wrong, but it was still held to be sufficient. The level of certainty at confrontation, this is where any improper influence from the first part of the test can make it through to the second part of the test. But if you look at their level of certainty, they didn't rush to conclusions. It was a deliberate process in determining this is the right guy because they had the light and the differing angles.
The impression that I got was that Becky makes the identification first and then Troy says, yeah, that's him. Is that not accurate?
That is accurate. And this court may determine that Troy's identification was not reliable, but the jury didn't need both identifications to be reliable. The credibility of witnesses was something that they got to determine, and they determined that at least one of those witnesses made a reliable identification.
So if the, let's say both identifications were stricken, they can still come in and testify at trial and say, that's the guy, and here's what we saw, and they can be cross-examined on, well, it's different than what you said that day, and things like that. I mean, that still comes in, right?
If the in-court identification were suppressed, then I don't believe that it would.
You don't think that comes in either?
Because that motion in limine would suppress that evidence of them making the identification in court.
Well, you think that if the court suppresses the out-of-court identification on the scene, that means that they would not be allowed to testify at trial?
No, I think they'd be allowed to testify, but the in-court identification would also be suppressed because it unreliably flows from the out-of-court identification. That's my understanding of how the test works.
So given the other state of the evidence in this case, do you think that the prejudice standard could be met if none of the identifications were admitted? Is there still evidence in the record?
So if you take out the identifications, if you take out the alleged hearsay statement, what the jury is left with is that Osman was seen within five blocks. Treadway first saw him at the 1300 block of 12th Street. The Millitzes lived on the 1800 blocks. They still know that after seeing the police officer, he was seen running west, the direct opposite direction of the crash. They still have Adane and Gully's testimony, so they still know that Adane, excuse me, gave Osman the key ring with the store keys and the Mazda key on it. They still know from Treadway that Osman had the key ring on him when he was arrested that had the store keys but no car key. And they still know that Treadway found the car key at the arrest site. So the key is the key in this case. That's what places Osman in the vehicle at the time of the crash. So there really is no prejudice here. If you take out Gully's statement, it doesn't change anything because the key is what connected the dots being found at the arrest site. And the key provides the connection between Treadway's course of action, the liquor store, the key ring, Osman, and the Mazda. So, no, I don't believe if you take out the identifications or the alleged hearsay statement that there's any prejudice suffered. I think that there's very strong evidence putting Osman in that car, and it comes from the key. With that, I'm near the end of my time. I'll cede the remainder and rely on my brief for any further analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Dempsey.
Thank you.
Ms. Dunn, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Ms. Dunn, when you were finishing out your earlier argument, I thought I heard the last comment, or one of the latter comments, to be the jury had failed to reach a verdict on the DWI coming, and that suggested to you that they were questioning whether he was in physical control. Did I hear that incorrectly?
I think they just were critical of the evidence. I don't think that they were...
Because they convicted him on one DWI.
Correct.
So they did find that out.
So I think based on the convictions of the hit and run and they found that he was the driver. They just didn't think have enough evidence as to the blood test count, and we had a 2-1. So my point basically was that I had a critical jury at that time, and so every piece of evidence mattered. And having that statement, the only statement where it says he was the driver, the only thing putting him behind the wheel, prejudiced my client. I wasn't allowed to argue the lack thereof, and so I think that made a difference in how the case was decided by the jury.
So continue with that thought. Opposing counsel says the key is the key, and even if we agree with you and we exclude the identifications and we exclude the hearsay, he says no prejudice here because essentially they found him very near the key and all of the other information. Tell me why he's wrong.
The key was not initially, I don't think the key is the key. This is an entire case that we're looking at here. The key is just one piece of evidence. And so if we're looking at, I'm going to go back with that. The key is one piece of evidence. So when we're looking at how everything played out at trial, the key wasn't found by like 5 or 6 officers who are trained to look for that on scene. And then Sergeant Treadway didn't find that until two hours later when he goes back. And I think that time lapse is noteworthy. And I also think the fact that these trained officers not finding it, not even looking for it on scene is noteworthy.
Did they know it was supposed to be on the key ring at that time?
I don't think that necessarily matters. I think if you are looking for the driver of the vehicle, you should be looking for the keys.
It seems like you're suggesting that there's some uncertainty about that you would have brought in front of the jury, I guess, is the idea. Did you do that at this trial?
I did. Yeah, I at least laid it out where the timeline as to how it all came out, the fact that Sergeant Treadway didn't even detain my guy when he first saw him. I think it goes to the credibility of the investigation that occurred here.
So even maybe a very similar line of questioning, and maybe too much on this area, but let's say it's out. Let's say that the identification's out, the hearsay statement about him driving's out, but everything else is in from Mr. Goulet and Mr. Dane. And so what's the theory of the defense?
That'd be a great trial. The theory of the defense is the same. They don't have the right person. They don't have anybody identifying who did it. They don't have, if they don't have an identification, if they don't have a statement of anybody being the driver, if they still wanted to try that case, they sure could.
It's a circumstantial case, and they just can't get there.
It's a lot less evidence. Okay. And I want to touch back on then just briefly on two things. One, the necessity. I think Chief Justice kind of discussed a little bit of whether how the strength of necessity. And one thing I wanted to point out is that Red Cloud is where this court discussed made that necessary analysis. However, if we look at the original case law concerning due process violations and suggestive show-up identification, the language, and forgive me, I am citing a dissent but from Manson v. Brathwaite, but they cite Stovall, where it says, the conduct of a confrontation may be so unnecessarily suggestive and conducive to irreparable mistaken identification as to deny due process of law. And so the wording there is different. Rather than unnecessary and suggestive, it says unnecessarily suggestive. And so I think that could go to how suggestive the identification procedure is. And then lastly, I want to point out that Troy Mellitz never made an identification that night. If you listen to Exhibit 101 that was received in evidence, he did not actually say definitively it was him. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted and will be in recess for the term.